I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday. Monday at 1 means all things political. And our guest this hour is Tamara Drought. She's Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, and she is the author of Sleeping Giant, How America's New Working Class Will Transform America. Her work has been covered by all kinds of newspapers and magazines, including the Washington Post, Newsweek, Business Week, Chicago Tribune, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. She's a frequent TV commentator. She's been on the Colbert Report, Today Show, CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC. And she's also author of Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. We are going to be looking at the election. There were a lot of appointments made by President-elect Donald Trump. We will talk about Steve Bannon this hour. We'll talk about Ryan Priebus, Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General, Michael Flynn, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who will be National Security Advisor. And we will be looking at analyzing the vote still, because it's what everybody is doing. She asks in a recent piece, did Democrats do something wrong? Absolutely, but not just in this election. For the last three decades, the party has abandoned pocketbook issues and working class people in favor of business leaders and Wall Street titans. And the Republican Party never had an economic platform for the working class, just its effective Southern strategy. Blame African Americans and now immigrants for white struggle and position. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of the hour, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tamara, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, good to be with you.
Hi, nice to have you here. Let's first of all talk about the resentment that you write about that won this election. Middle finger, throw caution to the wind, damn the consequences, vote, as you describe it.
That's right. I mean, I think that this was really a resentment election, and a resentment on a couple of different levels. One, this feeling that the economic challenges facing many people, particularly the non-college educated class, have been ignored for a very long time by both parties. It also is resentment, though, in terms, and this cannot be understated, the resentment towards the changing face of America. And this is about the progress. This is a backlash against progress. After the first African-American president, it's not really too shocking that we get a President Trump, because I think there is a sense, and the Republican Party has used this effectively, that gains for women or gains for Latinos or gains for African-Americans comes at the expense of white people in this country. And that has been a message that has been delivered time and time again by the Republican Party. And we saw it really form the centerpiece of Donald Trump's campaign. And so when I say that it was sort of like, damn the consequences, we have to remember who in this country is going to feel those consequences very deeply. And as, you know, to speak in broad generalizations, you know, white people, particularly white men, were the one demographic group that Donald Trump did not put on his list of the types of people who were behind what he considers the failing of America. And so I think we have to realize that as white people, and I'm a white person, the amount of privilege in being able to cast a vote for Donald Trump, the amount of white privilege that vote symbolizes, because everybody else in this country is now deeply, deeply afraid. For the first time, I think, in the history of the United States, we elected somebody who made children cry the following morning when the results were announced. People are literally afraid for their safety and their future in this country.
And yet, white women voted for Donald Trump in large numbers as well, didn't they?
That's right. White people in general in large numbers for Donald Trump. And I think, you know, this is important, and I say this in the piece you quoted. You know, absolutely not all Trump voters are racist or sexist. But it is absolutely true that Trump voters decided to vote for a man who was blatantly racist and sexist, and to be okay with that. And that, I think, particularly to be okay with his xenophobia comments, his comments, you know, about law and order, which is the sort of quintessential dog whistle, which started with Nixon, to be willing to say, let's give him a try, because I'm so upset with everything that's happening in this country right now that I'm willing to overlook his racist and sexist and xenophobic comments to send a message to the establishment. You know, a lot of people didn't have that luxury in this election because the consequences are so severe and so, and the stakes so high in terms of personal safety and security.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, when you think, we've had some very controversial appointments made over the last few days. We've seen major demonstrations in cities all over the country. We've had schools all over the country where principals are saying this is a safe place for people. There have been incidents of violence in schools and comments made to students. I'm wondering if we're going to move into a time where people accept this is the new president and we must, as a society, come together, whatever that means. I don't remember a time in history that was this divisive before somebody even entered office.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. And, you know, I think that there is definitely, and calibrating this balance is what is going to be so tricky. Yes, he is the next president of the United States. And I think particularly leaders of the Democratic Party, President Obama, Hillary Clinton, have all said, you know, we now are all invested in this transition being a success, and let's give him a fair and open heart, you know, and mind. Let's keep an open mind about him as he begins to assemble his team. I think that is true. He will be the president of the United States. That said, we have never seen a president like Donald Trump. And what we can't do is normalize the bigotry and misogyny that comes with his presidency. And I think we're already seeing, particularly the mainstream media, having a very hard time getting that balance right, where we could easily, and it's already happening, begin to normalize what is really outrageous bigotry and misogyny. And you see that in, you know, his first picks for his cabinet and his senior staff.
Let's talk about some other things before we get into some of those picks. You've written about this. He settled, I believe, on Friday or Saturday, this suit for $25 million. Of people who had sued him for fraud when it came to Trump University. You say that he ripped off people trying to get ahead. He is not a working class hero. Does that put that issue, though, aside? Was it smart of him to do that so he can have it out of the way, or does he face a lot more suits?
Well, I mean, he's got many outstanding lawsuits against him, not just about Trump U, but other issues. You know, I have long, you know, anytime he said something that really belies this idea of him as some working class hero, tried to call him out on it. And I think his phony populism will be a point in which I will continue to hold him accountable to the kinds of rhetoric he used about caring about pocketbook issues for people in this country, you know, the majority of whom clock in and earn hourly wages and don't get paid salaries. You know, this is a person who created a for-profit company designed to help people who wanted to get ahead, right? Like, learn how to work in real estate by the guy who, you know, the art of the deal guy. And it was a fraud and it was a scam. But again, preying on people who are trying to better themselves and improve their financial situation is exactly Donald Trump. That's what he does. You know, it came up in the debates. He is known for stiffing his contractors from architects down to janitors and dishwashers. And in his Vegas hotel, despite the workers voting for a union, he is fighting it tooth and nail and refusing to come and bargain and negotiate a first contract. So here's somebody who doesn't believe that people should be paid for their work, who is vehemently anti-union, which you know, has been historically responsible for the working class in this country having any sense of economic or political power. And one of the major societal shifts has been, you know, the death of the unionized workforce in this country. And with that death has come the loss of political and economic power for everybody in the working class.
And yet Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have both said if indeed he goes ahead with this trillion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar, however much money it's going to be, infrastructure, a lot of people may be put to work in this country, and maybe the jobs, you're an expert on the working class and have heard of, have talked to many people in the working class, would that not indeed help the standard of living for a large number of people who voted for him?
You know, infrastructure has long been an area where we have really not invested at the levels we need to, and that has cost lots of costs. One, in terms of we're not getting the level of job creation we need, and we're also just, you know, from a business standpoint, really inefficient, our infrastructure, whether we're talking about roads and bridges or the lack of high-speed internet all across this country. So I think it's great that he has really signaled that in his first 100 days he wants to do something big on infrastructure. Again, the devil's going to be in the details. You know, what we're already hearing is that basically his idea of an infrastructure package is really just more tax cuts for developers. That's not, I don't think, what the American people voted for when, you know, they assessed the many promises he made to finally invest in our physical infrastructure in this country. So, you know, yes, absolutely. If there's a real spending bill that is going to actually modernize this nation's infrastructure, I think that you will have many Democrats who will try and make that a good bill. And I think also try and make sure that those jobs go to people who really need them, and that there's equity built into modernizing our infrastructure.
Tamara, do you know anybody who's doing really good reporting on all of these Russian connections? This is popping up all over the place. Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, National Security Advisor, mm-hmm. giving a speech sitting next to Putin or close to Putin. He's invited to speak by the Russian state-owned television network. The reports that the Russian government did indeed hack the DNC, and I've been reading over the weekend also, hacked voter registration, voter polls, people who are on the registry to vote. There seem to be some really unusual connections here, to say nothing of how much Putin is admired by the current mm-hmm. president-elect. Who's doing reporting on this? Is mm-hmm. there something here that we should know about and we don't?
Yes, probably. In terms of the reporting, you know, I have not been following this angle as closely as some of the other angles. I do think, you know, this is one of those cases where the decline in investigative journalism is being felt and is palpable. You know, I think all of the stories you just mentioned with the connection to Putin and to Russia need to be investigated thoroughly. And it has been, you know, investigative journalists who have done that. And, you know, one of the things that Donald Trump has, you know, threatened to do is really actually even make it harder for journalists to do their jobs in this country in terms of holding leaders accountable and doing the kind of investigative work necessary to have a functioning democracy. You know, he wants to make libel law a lot tougher. He has threatened to close off access to reporters that and to outlets that don't cover him in a flattering light. You know, this is dictator-level behavior, and I think, you know, it has been clear again all along that this is a man who has much admiration for Putin. We know that Russia was behind the DNC leaks, and he, you know, for whatever reason, you can think nefariousness or maybe just ignorance, you know, I'm not sure which, does not seem at all bothered by these growing connections in Russia's involvement in our election process. I think it's deeply, deeply disturbing. And, you know, I think all of this goes to, you know, I forget who made the observation that progressives took Donald Trump literally but not seriously, mm-hmm. and his supporters took him seriously but not literally. I think what we're now in a place where we absolutely have to take him literally, because already the trajectory on which he has gone down in terms of his appointments, things he's already talked about, is, you know, restricting freedom of speech, appointing white nationalists to senior advisors in his administration. So he actually is now walking the talk, right? Everything he communicated about what he believed is now showing up in very serious ways. And we do have to take him seriously because he is now the president-elect. But we now also, I think, had good cause for taking him literally.
We're going to take phone calls. We have all our lines ringing, as you might imagine. Our guest for all things political is Tamara Drought. She is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos and is the author of Sleeping Giant, How America's New Working Class Will Transform America. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email, if you would like, at talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we like to read your comments always, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network. All right, two phone calls for Tamara, and we start with Pat in Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I'm just sighing a little bit here because, you know, we just had the election, and it seems like we're still campaigning. Now, I appreciate the fact that the death is clearly coming from the left. A big, obviously not a Donald Trump fan, and that's fine, but I just want to give her a little bit of perspective because I guess I'm one of those white males with the white male privilege and all that. But, you know, she wrote a book about the working class. And my question is, so far I've heard her talk about how awful white males are, racist, xenophobic, normalization, this, that, and the other thing. And that's not why I voted for Donald Trump at all. I voted for Donald Trump because through WikiLeaks, through the past 6 years with the IRS, government seems so corrupt. And I know people that voted for Bernie Sanders and thought exactly the same thing. Republicans, Donald Trump won 53% of the union vote, And if her idea is to try and get more white working class voters to get on board the Democrat side of the party, I think this conversation and talking down at all of us and telling us how racist we are for voting for Donald Trump, there's no room for us in the Democratic Party.
Tamara.
So I guess I would ask the caller whether he agrees, because I was very clear that not all Trump voters are racist or sexist. And I totally hear what he's saying. And I think a lot of Trump voters made the same calculation that the system is corrupt and that he was the best person to really sort of blow it up, right? But that, again, what I said, though, is that he was clearly making racist and sexist and xenophobic remarks. And a lot of white people in this country decided that was okay and voted for him anyway because their desire for change superseded any personal threats they may have that he was making for African Americans and for immigrants, documented and undocumented in this country. So I do think it is important to say that a lot of people woke up feeling very, very afraid and scared of their future in this country. And the ability for so many people to overlook those fears that their brothers and sisters in this country feel in a very deep and palpable way hurts. It actually hurts that so many people were willing to give this man a pass on fundamental questions of racial equity and gender is deeply upsetting to people. And it's a question we need, it's a conversation we need to be having in this country.
Pat? Are you still there, Pat? Oh, Pat's gone. Thanks very much for the call, Pat. Do you have any sense from the appointments that have been made at this moment, and what other appointments are you anticipating as soon as possible to get a sense of the ideology, the domestic policy of this new administration, the foreign policy of this new administration, Tamara?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing is, again, you know, I think let's talk about his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, who you know, has a long history of racism and anti-Semitism and misogyny. you know, as the executive chairman of Breitbart News. You know, he has been unabashed that he was the head of a media outlet that was the platform for the alt-right, which is really just a coded new name for white nationalists and white supremacy. So that is very, very scary. You know, then we have Sessions, who was appointed to be the attorney general, which is basically the top law enforcement office in our nation, who is charged with actually defending the civil rights of all Americans and protecting, indeed, the most vulnerable among us. And, you know, over the course of his career, we know a lot about Senator Sessions. And, you know, in the 80s, he was actually one of, you know, the few federal judges that were appointed and not voted in by the Senate because of his racism. So, you know, just those two appointments alone, again, go to what I would say was a big part of Donald Trump's platform, which was a very racialized appeal. And again, that doesn't mean that all the voters who voted for him are unabashedly racist individuals. But what it does mean is he was very clear about where he stood on these issues, and that, you know, when he said the era, you know, we've just gotten too politically correct, people on the alt-right mean that as we have gone too far in protecting the rights of women and African Americans and immigrants at the expense of white people. That is usually what that charge of being politically correct means. And so, you know, his appointments are very much in line with his rhetoric on the campaign trail. So on the one hand, it's not surprising because there's so much coherence between his rhetoric and now his appointments. But on the other hand, it's deeply frightening because I think no matter whether you're conservative, liberal, or somewhere in between, these nominations and appointees are so outside the mainstream of both conservative and liberal ideology.
Do you think Sessions will be confirmed?
I have no idea. I think one of the reasons he may be is because he's actually been in the Senate now for a very long time. And so he has himself and his positions have become normalized because he is a colleague, to 99 members of the Senate. He has been one of them for a very long time. So they may have a very difficult time not confirming him.
Let's go to Katie in Janesville next. Hello, Katie.
Hi, good afternoon. My comment, first of all, I did not vote for Trump, but I did not vote for Hillary either. Listening to your guest, my point is what I have put out over Facebook before is that he is our president-elect. This is what our future is going to be for the next 4 years. Whining and complaining and everything about whether we're comfortable with it or not is really a moot point at this time. What we need to do is to do more on a local level. The kids that are seniors right now in 30 years are going to be our presidents, our vice presidents, our governors. These are the kids that, for whatever reason, are dealing with this kind of stuff on a daily basis. If we cannot reach these kids now on a local level with a library, a school board, a town board, a city board, county boards, how the hell do you think we're going to change it ever on a national level?
Tamara?
Well, I really agree that we need to be investing and working with young people in this country, absolutely, because they are literally our future. But what I would say is every president has faced opposition. And the great thing about America is freedom of speech and that we do not have to be quiet when we see our elected leaders acting in ways that we believe are completely counter to American values and ideals. And I think that is exactly what is happening right now. And I think it would be very dangerous for people to just say because he's the president, he can do whatever he wants, and we shouldn't sort of highlight the deeply disturbing character of the people he is starting to surround himself with as he begins the very real task of governing this nation.
Leslie is next in Minnesota. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. First, I have 3 points. First of all, I really, really wish people would just let him get in there and see what he's going to do instead of armchair quarterbacking through this whole thing and speculating. I can never take speculation. Number two, when you talked about law and order, now, that is, to me, one of the main issues I voted for Trump. When I sat at my TV and watched how protests over different things, protests got out of hand, and our government from the very top told our law enforcement people to back off, stand down, let them, they need to.
Protest where, Leslie? What protests are you talking about? Now, I want to know what you're talking about. Protests where? What protests?
Protests all over, like Ferguson, like Baltimore, where they kept burning things. And when I say they, I'm not being racist. I'm saying all of the protesters, and I totally believe in a fair protest. I grew up in the 60s.
Okay.
I believe in protests, but when they are breaking the laws, hitting people with bricks.
All right, let's get a response. Tamara.
Well, I think one of the things that was so painful is the amount of violence that we actually saw at Donald Trump rallies. That, he did next to nothing to curb. And in fact was saying, you know, hey, I'll cover your legal bills for you, for the people who were ganging up on some of the protesters that were inside the rallies. He made a remark that, you know, it 50 years ago or so, that guy would have been carried out on a stretcher because, you know, his supporters would have beaten him to a pulp. So, you know, I do think that there is a real difference in the way we treat different types of protests in this country. I do think that there has been many of a police overreach in some of these protests, not in all of them. And I think also, you know, we just had the great, great different example of what happened when a bunch of white people protested federal lands out west. Never became, you know, the talk about standing down. We totally stood down and let them occupy federal lands for a very long time. You would not see that kind of response to African Americans occupying federal lands to make a point about Black Lives Matter. We have a history of, depending on who is doing the protesting, them being treated very, very differently.
You wrote recently, and you've done this book on the working class. Today's working class, you write, is no longer sitting on the sidelines, and you talk about movements like Black Lives Matter, the Fight for 15, reigniting a debate about economic and racial inequality, which is pretty amazing. I'm wondering what is going to happen to movements like Black Lives Matter and the Fight for 15. Do you think that a lot of that will continue on the local level, that the issue of racial equality is certainly not going away, and economic woes certainly not going away? What happens to those grassroots groups?
I think that they will definitely continue. I think that their work will be seen by their supporters and by themselves as more urgent than ever with a Republican Congress and Donald Trump as president. So I do think that we're going to see movements become stronger, become smarter. You know, one of the things the last caller said, she believes in protest. She's, you know, a kid of the 60s. I worked for a baby boomer who, you know, was involved in just about every movement in the 60s there was, you know, anti-war, consumers, civil rights, women's rights. And I never quite understood the solidarity of that time that happened among people who were really trying to change our country and its fundamental stance toward women and people of color and to national security. And in the last 3 or 4 years, I now can see it and understand it, because what we are seeing is a resurgence of movements of, by, and for the working class that are across racial and ethnic ideas, identities, that are men and women, you know, standing together in the streets to fight for economic and racial justice. So that gives me great optimism to see this resurgence. I do think that these protests and movements will continue and are, you know, going to be even more important with this new president.
Jim in Wauwatosa is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I want to make...
Can't hear you very well, Jim.
Okay, I want to make a comment regarding the Republican rhetoric when it comes to raising taxes, especially user taxes, for improving our infrastructure and mainly our transportation. I've been an advocate of this since the 60s, and I'm wondering what is going to happen now that Trump is in office. Is the Republican Congress, both state and federal, are they going to approve infrastructure improvement using a raising a tax? Because they have not been able to come up with anything so far in Wisconsin or federally to take care of this problem.
I don't know if there are any details on anything at this point. Tamara?
Yeah, there aren't really any details. And I do think that that has been the crux of the problem is the how are we going to pay for it? You know, we have a lot of national needs. And, you know, despite a lot of rhetoric to the contrary, you know, our tax rates are actually pretty much one of the lowest among developed nations. You know, as in terms of the amount of taxes we raise as a percentage of our GDP, there are only two countries that raise less money as a percent of their GDP than the United States, and that is Chile and Mexico. So we are really sort of cutting off our nose to spite our face when it comes to not raising enough revenue to meet our public needs, you know, which include infrastructure, both physical and human, you know, in terms of colleges and universities and our public schools, in our parks and our libraries. You know, back to what the last caller said, you know, we have really stopped investing in each successive generation in this country, and we need to do that, and we need to find ways to pay for it, because these are investments that benefit all of us in this country, and the money does need to come from somewhere. And so this recipe of just cutting taxes over and over again has left us in a place where we actually can't financially meet our country's needs.
I'm wondering what you think will happen with some signature programs, and let's start with Obamacare. Do you imagine that the Republicans will be able to reshape a health package that may be better, because everybody would admit there have been problems with Obamacare, that they will be able to repeal it and replace it with something that will be substantial? Do you think that that program will stay as it is? There are, when you were talking about people who are afraid of what's to come, there are people who are worried, they, in addition to Muslims and people who are here illegally from Central and South America and other places, Irish as well.
Right.
But there are large groups of people who are afraid. What about health care? Let's start with that.
Well, you know, we have 20 million people who now have health insurance who did not have it before Obamacare. And absolutely right. There are major aspects of the law that need to be, you know, tweaked. This was a major new initiative, and with something of this scale, you know, you have to make tweaks along the way. I think it will be very difficult to kick 20 million people off of health insurance. Politically, morally, all of it, that's a difficult thing to do. And so, you know, this may be one area where I think we might actually finally see some real responsible governance from the Republicans in Congress, who I would hope realize that forcing 20 million people to lose their insurance by just repealing the law is not a good idea. And so, you know, that will be the major challenge, is tweaking it and ensuring that we don't see the rate of uninsurance in this country skyrocket as a result.
Mm-hmm. What about those people who understandably are fearful now? There has been some talk of a Muslim registry. There has been talk by Dreamers, particularly, who were here because of executive order and who have built careers for themselves, were allowed to stay when they came very young. And those people might be deported, to say nothing of other people who are here, not legally. Do we need to figure out what the path forward is for those people? Because you don't want people living in fear.
Absolutely, that's right. And I do think, you know, the Dreamers, you know, are in a particularly precarious position because, you know, in some ways you can think of they are already registered with the federal government as being undocumented young people who were brought here by their parents when they were a young age. And they registered with the federal government to be allowed to stay here without fear of deportation, to start careers, to go to college, and now are, you know, I think rationally really worried about their future in this country. And I think, you know, we are already hearing, you know, Trump supporters and, you know, former surrogates on the news talking about how a Muslim registry wouldn't be against the Constitution or illegal because this person compared it to the internment of Japanese Americans during the war. So, you know, people, I think this is what's so hard and why our country feels so divided is because you have so many people who are literally fearful of their future in this country and a real lack of understanding that that is the case, right? That the this was not just Republican versus Democrat. We have never seen somebody like Donald Trump who used inflammatory rhetoric and made promises of deporting 12 million people in this country. That we're in uncharted waters here. And so back to the other caller, I would say it is these times when even if you voted for Donald Trump, when you are hearing incidences, you know, already in a playground in Brooklyn where I live, swastikas were painted, go Trump. You know, make America white again, swastika banners have been seen in this country. You know, there are incidences that are popping up, and Trump voters and Clinton voters alike need to stand firm and loudly against this kind of rhetoric and behavior. And I hope that we can get to that point, because I actually don't think that the people who voted for Trump voted for this kind of exclusion and bigotry. I really don't. But staying silent makes it seem as if that might be the case.
Tamara Drought is our guest for All Things Political this week, Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos. She is the author of Sleeping Giant, How America's New Working Class Will Transform America. She's also the author of Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network. Earl is our next caller in Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, I just want to speak on behalf of the elders. I'm 76, and what about all this going on? The population is growing older, and I don't hear anybody really talking about that. Social Security, they say it's going to run out. That has to be funded. And public transportation, Governor Walker is certainly against that. And then maybe even senior education or part-time work. I mean, a whole agenda of things.
Tamara.
Thank you so much for your call. I totally agree. I think, you know, already we have heard that Republicans in Congress want to fundamentally redo Medicare and not make it a guarantee of health insurance for older Americans. You know, Social Security, there are easy, you know, relatively easy ways that we could strengthen it. The least painful way being to actually have people pay taxes on more of their earnings. Currently, any amount you earn over $125,000 is not taxed and does not go into Social Security. So there are things that we could do to strengthen the system so that it will be around for many, many generations to come.
We go next to Myung, is it, from Milwaukee? Hello? Hello? All right, Gary is next. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello. Well, finally, a president that's going to make policy for all the people. This racism thing has been used to really, really hurt people for decades now, and it's used to legitimize people who really, really just bad behavior. Take all the Trump when they were protesting Donald Trump, it wasn't his people that were closing down interstate highways. It was Black Lives Matter and And they are going to, hopefully, be put in the background. It's going to be a government for all the people instead of just centering on minorities that need to pull their own weight, finally.
Well, Gary, what about those minorities, and this is factually based, who've been, you know, stop and frisk, pulled over repeatedly for offenses, black driving while black. There have been a whole host of disparities in how the criminal justice system has been treating people who are minorities in this country. There are legitimate grievances.
Well, we hear about them, but then if you look at the statistics of crime, whether it's shootings, murder, armed robbery, if you want to look at it, blacks take the lead. 60, 70, 80% of those crimes are committed by blacks. So would you have a different way of conducting yourself in a black area? You absolutely would. It would only be common sense. Even black people would it would be different the way they'd act in a black area as compared to a white area. So,
all right, Gary. Tamara.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
You know, I think Gary is actually representative of many people who did vote for Trump. And, you know, I mentioned the Southern strategy earlier. And one of the things that has happened is a really deliberate, orchestrated strategy to say that the benefits of government aren't going to white people anymore, that they are accruing, you know, the sort of fingers on the scale for minorities. And that has been said so many times for the last four decades across, you know, from Fox News to right-wing talk radio. And it has become sort of this truthism among a lot of white people. And it's really deeply destructive because I would love, and I hope that Gary is right, that Donald Trump actually does govern for all people. I really worry that he's actually not going to do that. And I just want to say, you know, I come from a working class family, from a white working class family. In my book, I argue pretty vigorously also with the Democratic Party, who at a time when jobs were declining, wages were declining, the Democratic Party really moved away from being the party of the working class and moved away from pocketbook issues and you know, became much more the party of business elites and upwardly mobile professionals. And I think that was a mistake, and I continue to think it's a mistake. And I think the Democratic Party is actually having its own soul-searching endeavor right now. And there is a fight over the soul of the Democratic Party, and I think, you know, all indications are is that it is going to go back to being the party that it always was, which is the champion of the little guy. You know, that has been the role of the Democratic Party, and that message has been lost. But it also can't come at the expense of the rights and freedoms of people in this country who are not white. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to really build this country together, and this question of who deserves what from whom in this country is part of what we have to be talking about in this country. So I thank Gary for calling, but I worry that, you know, he has bought into a myth that isn't real and that really maligns, you know, our brothers and sisters in this country who are struggling to get ahead and do right by their families, and paints them in these stereotypes that aren't real, but have been so heavily promoted for the last four decades.
Let's spend a little time, because this is your expertise as well, and it certainly was one of the huge motivating forces for the election of Donald Trump and the challenge that Bernie Sanders gave to Hillary Clinton, and that is the plight of the little guy and the little gal. You write about manufacturing jobs that got shipped overseas. It's hard to imagine that a lot of those jobs are coming back. The working class shifting from making stuff to serving people. What happens now to the little guy and the little gal? Who's offering something to help them financially?
Well, you know, this is the big question, right? I think, you know, what we have not heard, and you know, I wrote articles saying that Clinton needed to do this. Trump didn't do it either. We have got to commit to making the jobs that are already here good jobs, that all jobs in this country should pay, you know, a decent wage and, you know, have stable schedules. And you should, when you have a baby, you should be able to take time off and still feed your family and yourself. We have got to get serious about job quality in this country. One of the biggest trends that have happened in the last three decades is the big divide in quality of life for people with college degrees and people who don't have college degrees. You know, neither of my parents had a college degree. My dad was a union steel worker and my mom was an office manager. And despite neither of them having college degrees, they were able to raise a family of six. I had three siblings, in middle class comfort. That's unachievable today without a bachelor's degree. And what we've done is actually make a bachelor's degree much harder to get because it's so expensive as states have cut funding. And we've really retrenched. You know, the minimum wage has lost its purchasing power. Benefits like retirement and health care are disconnected from your job. So we have a lot of work to do to make the jobs that are here that aren't being shipped overseas, our home health aides, our janitors, our retail workers, good jobs. It would be great if we could have a manufacturing revival, but we can't just put all our eggs in that basket. There are lots of jobs here that are growing, that pay very poorly, but are vitally important, and home health aides is a big one. Mm-hmm. So I want to hear, what are we going to do to improve job quality for people who don't have college degrees in this country?
I'd like to hear answers to that as well. Eric in Madison, hi.
Hi. Say, when you live in fear of the government, you live in tyranny. And when the government fears the people, you have liberty. And I'm petrified right now with the president-elect. And given the situation that we have with the Patriot Act, and, you know, people need to read the Bill of Rights and then examine the Patriot Act. And they're going to find out that Donald Trump has got a license to do what he wants, when he wants, and with absolutely no congressional oversight.
Well, we do have a system of checks and balances, Tamara, don't we?
Well, we do. We do, though, have, right now, we have a Republican who will be in the executive office and also controlling Congress. So, you know, that can be difficult, and I think the issues that this caller raises are real. They were real even under the Obama administration. I think their surveillance state has a lot of people very worried, and it does not seem, you know, protecting civil liberties certainly does not seem like a priority of this new president. So it's worrisome.
Mary sends this email. I've read that a very high percentage of church-going Christians voted for Donald Trump, with Pope Francis so outspoken about racism and care for refugees, as well as the teaching of love and care for one another of the Christian faith. What insight does the speaker have about this inconsistency?
Well, it's head-scratching. I think a lot of people are asking that question. I think that a lot of evangelical Christians, I'm not one, so I don't want to speak on behalf of them, but I think the question of Donald Trump being anti-choice, anti-safe and legal abortion was a big one. And I think a lot of folks that is a single issue, they're single issue voters, that stance will determine who they vote for. And I think for a lot of evangelical Christians, Donald Trump's promises to appoint Supreme Court justices that would overturn Roe v. Wade was a deciding factor for them.
Tamara, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Kathleen.
Tamara Drought, Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos. She's the author of Sleeping Giant, How America's New Working Class Will Transform America, also author of Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. We hope joining us next week, we had David Winston scheduled for this hour, who is Republican and has worked very closely with Newt Gingrich. He will offer his thoughts about the election and the days and months ahead, and we hope next week. He had a medical emergency this morning, so he couldn't be with us today. So listen to his voice, a different voice, probably next week on All Things Political. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, John Munson will be filling in for me, and he'll be talking about adult-use marijuana laws. Several more states passed laws legalizing the drug. He'll explore what that means for the country and the new administration tomorrow during this hour. Coming up momentarily, news from NPR, and we'll be back.